Hi, my name is Cindy. And I'm a grateful Al-Anon member. And I want to thank Kara for this commitment. And when Kara asked me to do this, I thought it was a joke. And I kept asking her, are you sure you got the right person? And I kept asking her until to the point where she started to doubt it herself. And she went back and asked the long-timer of the group to make sure that it was me. And I want to thank Sue for suggesting that I do this commitment. And I know that the one spiritual thing about this is that I'm here today. From where I come from, by all means, I shouldn't be standing here. I should be, I think about where I should have been today. I should be on welfare with a bunch of kids and a gangbanger in jail. And that's where I come from. I grew up in a family with 7 kids, and my parents came here from Mexico to find a better life for us. And basically, I know that part of that was they were following a drunk. My uncle was a drunk, and my parents' responsibility was to make sure that he was okay wherever he went. And he came to California, and they came to follow him to make sure that everything was okay, because my dad, he took care of him, and he protected him every time he got into fights. And that was my dad's responsibility to keep him out of trouble. And I grew up thinking something's wrong, but something was wrong with me. I didn't know what it was, and I just felt like I didn't fit into that family, and I thought that I was adopted because they were all dark skin, dark hair. And I was white, and I was called honky a lot when I was growing up, white girl, and okey, and all those words. And I believed them when they called me that, because I didn't think I belonged in that family. But I didn't really think that, you know, I had that little self-righteous part of myself that there's something wrong with them, not with me, you know, because I fit in where we were at. They didn't fit in, because in the neighborhood that I grew up in when we first moved in there weren't very many Mexicans there, and our family stood out, you know, because we spoke Spanish, and nobody in that neighborhood spoke Spanish but us. And I thought that's the problem, you know, we don't fit in here. And for a long time, I didn't know it was alcoholism. I thought it was the fact that we were Mexican. That was the problem. And my sisters were tough, and I wasn't. I was scared all the time. And for a long time, my sisters and my brother, they were my protectors. And if you were a guy and you did something to me, I'd tell my brother, but I would add to it so that he would beat you up. My brother is now he's 6'4", and he's big. So everybody in school was afraid of him because he was the biggest there in school, and my sisters were tough. And I remember my friends used to ask me, are your sisters in a gang? And I say, no, they're in a social club. They had this little group. My parents were very naive, and they had this little group they hung out with. You know, they had the jackets and the makeup and the streaks in their hair and the Pendletons and the khakis. And they told my mother that it wasn't a gang, it was a social club. And the things that they did was, it was social. They were going out. And they didn't tell my mom that they were going out and beating up on other girls and, you know, running down girls with cars. They didn't tell her all that stuff. And my mom believed, you know. And I know that my mom kept a lot from us. She tried to make everything okay. And she thought that I didn't know a lot of what was going on, but I listened a lot. You know, I listened. You know, I listened to those conversations that my parents would have when I was sleeping about my uncle. Why is he flying to Colombia again? You know, what is he doing? You know, what's this business about? This is a front. I listened to all that stuff, and I took it in. I just never said anything, you know. And I remember being in the room, and my brother sitting in the living room, and the dean of school's in our living room, and my brother got kicked out of school. And when I asked my mom why, she said, well, he's not kicked out of school. He's just getting such good grades that he's going to do home teaching now, and he's going to work. And basically what my brother got kicked out of school for was he was selling drugs, and my sister was his supplier. And, you know, but my mom, the way she made it look is that he's really smart. And when my friends asked me why my brother wasn't there, that's the story that I gave them. You know, he's really smart and he's working, and for some reason they let him graduate at the end with the class. So that's like everything looked okay. And I know that there was a lot of chaos in our family, and, my dad took my little sister and I along with him whenever all those insanity, those chases. I remember, my older brother is a drunk, and today I can say that, and today I know what it is. And he's taken on the same route as my uncle. And I remember chasing him down. He was in a car he was cheating on his wife. And my dad had myself and my little sister in there, and we chased him down. And I remember jumping out of that car and going to the door where my brother was in his car. We were at a signal and yelling at my brother and telling him, how could you do this? How could you cheat on your wife? And, you know, I know my brother was just doing what he knew how to do. He was getting loaded, and he was out there womanizing. And that's what he learned, you know, because he grew up with my uncle. And I remember my sister, it's like, there's like all these little things that now that I've come into the program, it's put together, and I know that it's alcoholism. And my sister, I don't think she's a drunk. I think she's one of us, and she's pretty intense, and she reminds me a lot of Sue. You know, she's rough like that, you know, and she beat up people, and she didn't care if you were a guy or a girl. She jumped out of cars and punched guys in the face and got back in the car and would take off, and I'd be in the car with her. You know, she didn't care. You looked at her the wrong way, she punched you. She didn't care. My friends were afraid to come over the house. She was my protector, you know, and I remember my sister getting involved with a guy fresh out of prison. And doing the drug thing, coming home loaded with, you know, and I remember physically with my brother throwing my sister out of the house. You know, it's like, you know, we can't take this anymore. She was stealing from my mom, and she was causing a lot of insanity. I was the one on the phone with my mom when she wouldn't come home. You know, she wouldn't come home for weekends, and I was on the phone calling the hospitals looking for her. And, you know, eventually we kind of knew she's not coming home. We're not calling anymore. We're not calling the police. We're not calling the hospitals. And she had to do her deal. And, you know, and I know the reason that I don't think she's a drunk is because a few years ago she was sharing with me how she was sobering up gang members. And she was handcuffing them to chairs and putting them in her garage to sober them up. And my sister's crazy. She's crazy, you know. And a couple of years ago I was talking to her and then she tells me how she beat up the neighbor. It's like she's still doing it, you know. My sister's still doing it. She's crazy. The Al-Anons, they're not Al-Anons, but the non-drinkers in my family are crazier than the drinkers, you know. And that's just basically the kind of family that I come from. And I know that there was a lot of denial of the disease in my family. And every uncle on my mom's side of the family has died of alcoholism. We just never called it alcoholism. You know, we called it, you know, he has liver problems, he has kidney problems. And when I got here to the program, it's like I've had the awarenesses through people sharing. You know, I remember watching one of my going to the hospital to visit one of my uncles, and he was huge. He was swollen and he was yellow. And I remember him dying. And I've gotten to in the program see one of my uncles die of alcoholism, and today it's like I knew what it was, and I got to have some compassion for that. And he was my favorite uncle. He used to pay me to bring him beers, and it's like that's how I made my money. He didn't have any daughters. He had five sons, and we had five girls in our family, and so he totally loved on us, and he gave me all the attention. My uncles that are the drunks gave me all the attention that I ever wanted, and they just made me feel special. You know, it's like every time I was around them, I felt like I was special, and they gave me that special attention, and I was attracted to that. And I felt like in our family we're boring. You know, why don't my parents get divorced, or why don't we ever move? And I just felt like my family was really boring. And the excitement was at my cousin's house, and that's where I always wanted to be. And you know, it came to a point where I know that there was a fight between my dad and my uncle, and I know there was drinking involved. And I just remember them packing up the car with all the kids, the station wagon, and say, we're getting out of here and we're not coming back. And I remember my uncle being drunk. I just don't remember the whole gist of it. And there was a lot of a gap and a lot of years before we went back to that house. And it's just like we just isolated. My parents were trying to keep us away from the drinking and hide us from it so that we couldn't see. And nevertheless, that, you know, we'd walk out of the front of our house and there'd be somebody shooting up in front of the house. You know, there'd be the guys down the street getting loaded, and that's where I walked through there every day to go to school. That's what I went to school with. But to me, that was normal, because that's where I thought everybody lived. That's all I knew. And, you know, when I started getting out of that little area, the neighborhood that I didn't know that there was life outside of the neighborhood where I grew up in. And, you know, I thought that that's all there was. And when, you know, I got to high school, I started to find out that there was life out there, and I started to enjoy doing those things like drinking and getting loaded. And but that's what was around me, you know. And I thought, it's no fun to be good, you know. That wasn't fun. The people that were having fun were the people that were causing trouble in school, the people that were leaving school, the people that were getting loaded. And that's where I thought the fun was. And I don't know how I graduated from high school. I was the right below the valedictorian. And that was, everybody laughed about it because I did school a lot, and I don't know how I did that, but it just happened. And but you know what, school and being good wasn't paying off for me. It was, I wanted to have fun. And you know, I started hanging around with a lot of gangs, guys, not girls. Girls weren't fun. I'd hang out, but it's like I justify what I did. I thought, I'm not going to be like my sisters, so I'll just go to another neighborhood where nobody will see me. And I went to all those neighborhoods where I was told that I shouldn't be, because if I was there, I was going to get my butt kicked. And that's where I went, because it's like just the whole idea of the excitement of doing what I wasn't supposed to be doing and being where I shouldn't be was intriguing to me. And, you know, it's like I hung out with guys and dead-end streets that used to shoot out the lights, and we'd hang out there and drink and get loaded with them. And I enjoyed being with them, and I participated in that to be with them. And, you know, the first boyfriend that I wanted to get married to, that I was so in love with when I was 17 years old, I met him the first day he got out of Chino prison. And, you know, when I heard that he had gotten out of prison, it's like, yeah. You know, and everybody was around him, because that's what they do in the neighborhoods. You know, they get out of prison and they make a big deal. You have a big party because he's out. And that's what I wanted. And, you know, and it excited me that he was willing to drive into our neighborhood and pick me up to take me out. And there was always a gun under the, you know, he had a lowrider Impala, and there was always a gun under the seat, you know, and that's the way he got in. And it's like then we would just zoom out to go. And that excited me, you know, and I never thought that I could be hurt, or that, you know, that anything can happen, because I felt like I was invincible. You're like, nothing can happen to me as long as I'm with him. And, you know, that got kind of old for a while, because I saw that that wasn't going to take me anywhere. I was always in search of someone who was going to take me away from this bad life that I had, and somebody that was going to rescue me. And it took a little while for me to figure out that a gangbanger wasn't going to take me out of there. You know, somebody that didn't work at all he did was get loaded wasn't going to take me out of that. And I started to look for Mr. Right somewhere else. And, you know, I tried everything to fix me. You know, I wanted to be rescued. And I tried everything. I tried all hanging out with all different kinds of people. Then it's like, okay, well, I'll just step a notch up. I'll hang out with these guys that go to have car clubs. At least they have nice cars, you know. And you know, it's the same thing. I was doing the same thing, and then everything really took off for me when I started going to clubs in Hollywood. And there's this one place that I used to go to, and it was called Circus. And it was a circus. You know, you walk in there, it's a warehouse, and there's any type and every type of freak in there. You know, there were gays, there were anything, you name it there, and people were getting loaded everywhere. It's like the upstairs, you know, if you want to do coke, you go upstairs. If you want to do, they called it locker room, on the dance floor, you can do that there. And there were drinks flowing, you know, and it was free for me, because I just had to smile and I'd get whatever I wanted, you know. And and it helped me to feel like I fit in, you know, and I felt like I was special there. And you know, and I never seen so many guys in one place. And and that's just like my whole mentality has always been. It's like I lived in this little neighborhood where I was just limited, and then all of a sudden I started to get out and see that there was another world out there. But I was always looking for a fix, and I always thought that it would come in the means of a man. I was going to meet a rich man, and he was going to take me out of where I was living, because poor me. And but the places that I was looking for them were, I wasn't going to find a rich man there, but I thought, you know, I'd interview. You know, it's like, what do you do for a living? What kind of car do you drive? Where do you live? And then I look at the clothes, and I look at the shoes. If the shoes don't match the clothes, then he really didn't have money. And, and you know, it's like I did that. And one thing is that I know that for myself that no relationship ever fixed me. You know, no one guy ever fixed me. And I just thought, you know, it's like my friend and I, we had this saying is that men are like money in the bank. You always have to have some in the bank, because you never know when you'll need to withdraw. And it's like one was never enough. It's like this one had this quality, that one had this quality, and this one would give me this attention, and that one would give me that attention. And I never had any ambition to get married or settle down, because I was always on the search. And I never felt that I could be faithful in a relationship. You know, so I thought, it's like, what's the use? If I were to get married, I would cheat. So why even bother with that? So I never, you know, had these dreams of walking down the aisle with the white dress, or all these things that most girls have growing up. I didn't have those dreams, you know. It's like, I just wanted to have fun. That's all I wanted to do, was have fun and be irresponsible and have somebody take care of all those bills. I charged up a storm in credit cards because, and I really, really believed this, that I was going to meet a rich man and he was going to pay all those bills. And there was just, that wasn't an insane thought to me. That was like, that was to me, I thought that's reality. You know, you just cause all this wreckage and somebody's going to clean it up for you. But you just got to keep looking for that right person and just keep building up that wreckage as you go along. And, you know, the day came when Mr. Wright walked in the door, and he had a suit on and he had the right shoes on. And I remember telling my friend, I want him. I'm going to get him. And it took me a while to work it, but, you know, it's like, I don't think that I got him. It was funny. The night that I saw him at a club, and he came up to me, and he asked me to dance, and he asked me for a ride home. Later on, I found out that he had DUIs, and he never drove to a club because he didn't want to get one on the way home. So they take a cab to the club, and then they find girls to take them home. And it didn't matter who they were, just somebody. And I remember going up to his apartment and then him telling my friend and I, take off your shoes. And we're like, take off our shoes? And he said, don't make a lot of noise. Just take off your shoes. And the reason was that they always had girls up there. And, you know, girls with their high pumps making all that noise. So the landlord knew that they'd have parties with girls up there all the time. So you had to be quiet going up there so that he wouldn't get kicked out of there. And when I walked into that apartment, and this is my insanity, is that the couch was turned upside down. There was papers all over the place. There was joints in the refrigerator. And I didn't see anything wrong with that. And I thought, oh, he needs help. He needs somebody to clean this place for him. And I took that on as my responsibility. And that was my way in. And, you know, later on I found out that he had a BMW and his parents had a business, so that was even more plus. You know, and so it's like I took the responsibility of taking care of him. And I'd go to that apartment and clean it up. And, you know, I'd go in the morning to work at 7 o'clock and take him breakfast. And it never, like, clicked to me, like, he's drunk at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I didn't see anything wrong because, you know what, he was doing what we did. That's what we did. We went out, we got drunk, and, you know, woke up in the morning hungover. I went to work. I'd come home at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'd go to work at 7 o'clock hungover. And I saw nothing wrong with that. So I'm like, we're just doing what we do. And that's just what we grew up around, and that's just what we did. And I saw nothing wrong with that. I thought, just one day he's going to stop. And, you know, I got tired of that one day because it wasn't happening. And I don't even know where I got it from. I remember telling him, you need to go to AA. And he told me, you're calling me an alcoholic? And I thought, oh, maybe I'm wrong. And I just let it go. But then I thought I'd punish him by leaving him. And so I broke off that relationship. And, you know, but part of me was like, he's going to want me back. You know, he's going to see how bad it is without me, and he's going to want me back. And he never called me. So then I thought I'd punish him by getting another boyfriend and letting him know. And he didn't care. You know, and I'm the one who came back. You know, it's like my dad passed away, and I needed a fix for the pain. And a drunk was a fix. You know, so when my dad passed away, the first thing that I did is I didn't call the boyfriend that I had at the time. I called the drunk. And he was my fix, and he became my fix. And I thought that he could fill that emptiness that I had inside, and never knowing that it was a God hole. You know, always thinking that there's something missing and I just need to find it. I was on a race, and every time I got to the finish line, I found that I wasn't getting there and I needed to keep running. And I caused a lot of pain in a lot of people's lives, and friends' lives, and my family's life. You know, it's like I wasn't a drunk, but yet I took a lot of the same actions. You know, I remember coming home so loaded and crawling into the house and my mom watching me. And waking up and wondering, how did I get here? And looking out the window, my car's there. It's like I did those things to be with them, you know. And it's like I knew that I needed to, if I wanted to be with him, I needed to be able to hang with him. So I drank tequila. That's what he drank. And I thought, I can hang. You know, I can hang with him. But the time came when I got tired of that. You know, I got tired of sitting in the apartment and watching him drink. You know, and I thought, you know, it's time to settle down. And, you know, he moved from Pico Rivera to Fullerton, so I thought, that's going to fix it. And I followed him and moved to Fullerton, too. And, you know, I thought, he just needs to get away from that friend. And he had this one friend that used to, they'd sit on the floor and they'd turn on, I don't even remember the song, and they'd go like this the whole time. And I used to get the vacuum cleaner and I'd vacuum into them while they were doing that. And I even went so far as like I got his friend in my car and I took him home because I thought that was the problem. And it's like it would make me crazy because just as soon as I knew I got him to the house where he was at, I come back and he was there again. And I'm like, how did he get back here so quick? I just couldn't get away from him. And you know that I know that that guy John, he saved me a lot from getting hit. You know, he'd get in the middle of us so that the guy that got me here wouldn't hit me. And he didn't interfere a lot with that. And but I wanted him out because he was the problem. And my disease really started to take off once we moved out here to Fullerton. And we sat in a studio apartment a lot, and I watched him drink a lot, and I got angry a lot. And, you know, I even tried being drunk when he'd get home from work so that he could see how stupid it was. And, you know, he'd shove me out of the apartment and tell me to leave, and I wouldn't leave. You know, I'd come in through the sliding door and come back. And he couldn't get rid of me. You know, he wasn't going to get rid of me. And we did a lot of crazy things, you know, chased each other down the alleys. We had this thing where he dove on my car, and I kept going, and he rolled around, and it was just, there was a lot of drama there. You know, there's a lot of drama, but you know what? I wasn't leaving because I knew something's wrong with me that I can't stay in a relationship, and I'm going to make this one work, and I'm not giving up. And so I'm grateful for that relationship because that's what got me here. You know, my family's alcoholism would never get me here. It's like I had to go out there and run my own out there, and you know, it's like there was violence in that relationship, and I initiated a lot of it. I had a lot of anger. It's like I kept a lot of things inside, and I didn't know how to communicate. I didn't know how to talk, how to say what I felt. I felt that he should read my mind. He should know what I want. He should know what I'm thinking. And when he didn't get it right, I'd get angry. And it was like in little subtle ways that I thought, you know, by throwing things at him, and saying, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that. And, you know, I was going crazy. And I thought that the solution is that he needs to move out of this apartment. This is small. And in the meantime, I went to his parents. I had never met, through this whole relationship, I never met his family. I just knew of them. And I decided that maybe his family can help him get sober. So I called his parents up and told them that their son had a problem and that only they can help him. And but I told them, but don't tell them I called you. And they met with me, and I told them everything. And I remember his dad always telling me, Cindy, why don't you just leave? And I said, but I love him. And no sooner did I get home that they had already called him, and that just made it worse, you know. And he tried several times to get sober, but it was never because he wanted to. It was just to get us off his back, just to keep the things that his family had given him, you know, because they had money. And one of their fixes for him was to buy him a house and buy him a business, buy him a restaurant. And that was their way of keeping him busy so he wouldn't drink. And his dad would call me occasionally to ask me if he was still drinking. I always said, no, he's not, knowing that he was. And it just kept getting crazier. And we moved into the perfect little neighborhood, you know, with all the white picket fences, looked good on the outside. And we moved midnight the day before New Year's. And he and I moved everything at midnight, and we found some drunk wandering around, and he told them, you know, if you help, then you can take the stuff that I don't want. And we thought that, you know, this way the people don't see us moving in, they won't know who we are, and we wake up in the morning and we're already living there. And I thought that was a great idea, because then it was going to be New Year's, and if we started the New Year's right and off in the right neighborhood, everything was going to be okay. And it's just like that was just the beginning of the end. And it just got crazier. You know, the outside looked really good, but if you were to walk into the house, there were holes on the wall. The carpet was burned. It smelled sour when you walked in with smoke and the drinks that were spilled all over the place. There was no furniture. There was only a bed and a couch in the family room and a TV on the floor. Oh, and a treadmill in the dining room, because he said that if he could do the treadmill for an hour, he wasn't a drunk. And I believe. I'm like, how could he do that for an hour? Get up at 7 in the morning, work 10 hours, come home and drink? And I thought, well, maybe I have, something's wrong with me, because I can't even do that stuff and I don't even drink. And so the treadmill was there to prove to me that he didn't have a problem. And every now and then when I'd nag him, he'd jump on the treadmill for an hour. And and things just got crazier, and I yelled and I screamed and I threw things, and I started to plot in my head how I wanted him to hurt like I hurt. And nothing that I could say or do would make him hurt like I hurt. And I fantasized killing him and getting away with it and how I can do it. And I really thought, I can really get away with this. And that thought scared me, that I could really kill him and get away with this. And I didn't want my family to know, because I knew that if my brothers knew that this was going on, they'd just do him in. And my sister would make the right phone call, and he'd disappear. And because that's how my family is. It's like, you don't, blood is thicker than water. And there's a loyalty there, that no matter what we do to each other, we stick together. And you better not do anything to us, because whether I'm right or wrong when I do something to you, if my sister sees you do it, it doesn't matter. You did it to me. You know, and that's the loyalty that's there. And it's still there. The good thing is that I don't have to participate in that anymore. And so I never told anybody what was going on. But I know that my mom knew that something was wrong, because physically I was ripped apart, you know, and there was no way that you couldn't tell that something was wrong with me by looking at my outsides. And I'd stay away a lot, because I just couldn't. You know, I couldn't go over there and let them see what was going on, because I knew that I couldn't fool them. Because, you know, I have a sister who's got 5 kids, and she's living with that gangbanger still, in and out of jail a lot. And she walks around with bruises occasionally. And she's taking those kids through hell. And, you know, one of them's already been in prison. One of them just living in East L.A., and she just had her 2nd kid, not married. And I try to save kids. They were my project for a long time. But money can't rescue you from alcoholism. Things can't rescue you from alcoholism. You know, it's like, I've heard Keith share, it's like, you know, from the time they're set what they're going to be. And that's what they grew up in, that's what they're doing. And it's like, I couldn't rescue them. And I was doing the same thing. I judged her for living that way, but yet I was living the exact same way. You know, but I thought, well, but you know what? I have things on the outside. I bring those Nordstrom boxes every Christmas, so I'm okay. You know, I'm not asking them for money, so I'm okay. But I was doing the exact same thing. So I isolated from my family, and I don't live that far from them. And my mom would make phone calls occasionally to people that I work with to ask to see if I was okay. And they started calling his family, and that pissed me off, because they started calling his family looking for me. And that just made me stay away from them even that much more. And I hated her. You know, it's like, why is she meddling in my life? Because part of growing up with my mom is she's deeply affected by this disease. And when stuff started to happen in our family, she just stayed in bed. And my brothers and sisters, there's the age gap between us. And I felt my mom wasn't there for me. You know, she focused so much on them and what was going on with them that she wasn't there for me. She was in bed a lot. And the doctor's solution to that was Valium. And she took a lot of Valium, and she was in bed a lot, and she couldn't function for a long time. And when she decided that she wanted to be a part of my life, and she passed that phase, I was like, screw you. You weren't there when I needed you, and I don't need you now. And so I just, like, pushed my family away. You know, eventually I got to a place where it's like I just couldn't keep it together anymore. I was driving 2 hours to work because I thought that was my fix, that money was my fix. You know, hanging out with these doctors and their wives at work was going to fix me. None of that was fixing me. And I was insane. I was driving around. I thought, it's a sports car, though. Little sports car with the inside of the car was ripped off because he tried to jump off out of the car on the freeway. And I had the car locked. He never knew that the door was locked. But it was the whole drama. I was going 70, and he's trying to jump out of the car. And so he ripped the whole side of the car. There's holes in there. That car was just barely making it to keep me to work. And, you know, what finally got me here is he tried one more time to get sober. And I thought, okay, this is it. You know, if he doesn't stay sober, I just can't do this anymore. And I remember going to the hospital and doing that little group thing where you sit in the circle. He had his parents and me there, and I remember telling him, this is the last time. If you get drunk again, I'm out of here. And then I don't remember what his parents told him, but that just ticked him off, and he ran out. And I was like, oh, my God. And, you know, it's like the whole drama with me. And one thing, though, that I did hear in that session is there was an alcoholic that was running that group, and he shared with me. He said, you know, he asked me if I drank, and I was, like, on and off with that. And he said, you know, I don't date women who drink. He says, I'm sober. And he said, and me kissing a woman that just had a drink is like me taking a drink. And I heard that, and that stood with me. And I wasn't here yet, but that stood with me. And that was the one thing that I did here that time. And, you know, I remember leaving that and standing outside in the rain, the whole dramatic story, and his dad telling me, Cindy, why don't you just leave? You know, and I don't know how many times that man told me, Cindy, why don't you just leave? I remember them asking me, does he hit you? I said, no. And it's like, you know, just at that, I wasn't going to leave. So he went through the 3-day thing, and I was calling the hospital. You're letting him out too soon. That's not long enough. He needs to be in there longer. Don't you know he's going to drink when he comes out? You need to keep him there. We'll pay. It doesn't matter how much it costs. They wouldn't keep him. And so I decided that I needed to take matters into my own hands. And prior to that, it's like I took him to AA a lot. I went to AA a lot with him. And I know that I probably went there more for me than for him, because every time I went there, I heard hope. I heard hope for him. And I didn't, not knowing that I needed something for me. And you know that I know today that AA meetings, they do give me hope for the alcoholic, but I need Al-Anon for me. And so I decided, I picked him up on a Friday, took him to lunch, took him to the movies, took him to an AA meeting, and I was going to do this every day. You know, and it's like he just couldn't handle it. He was still shaking, you know, and I knew what he was going through, because he tried to get sober at home a couple of times, so I know what it looks like to watch somebody go through DTs, you know. But I at that time I had no compassion, you know. I thought, just stick it out, just do it, you know. And I had no compassion for him, and he was the kind of drunk. He had seizures when he went through DTs, and I thought, if I just hug him and love him, he'll be okay. You know, I had no clue what he was going through. Today I do know, because of this program and because I've gone to open AA meetings. And, you know, nevertheless, he got sober on a New Year's Eve, and I thought, wow, that's great. He's in the hospital New Year's Day, starting the New Year right. He's going to be sober from now on. And 5 days later, he took another drink. I walked. He told me, I was driving him so crazy that he came home with those, you know, those little bottles, the little ones that they give you on the airplanes of tequila, and he put it on the counter, and he said, I'm going to show you that I don't have to drink. And that just ripped my gut apart when I saw that bottle sit at the counter. And I come home every day, and I look at the counter. It's still there. And the day came when I walked in, and that bottle was in his mouth. And I didn't have anything else to say. I flipped him off, and I walked out the door. And I was desperate. And I knew that I needed something. I just didn't know what it was. So I thought, church, help me. I can't do this anymore. I went home and I had the courage. I had called Al-Anon before. But you know, the times that I call is when there's nobody to answer the phone. Those are the times that I called. And this time I thought, you know what? F it. I'm leaving a message this time. It doesn't matter. You know, and I left a message that I needed to go to a meeting. And I left my phone number. I didn't care anymore. I didn't care who knew or who found out. I just knew that I needed something. And I like when Keith shared about last night, is that little pilot light. You know, there's always been something inside of me that I've always wanted more. I was misdirected all my life until I got here. And I just didn't know what more was. And, you know, that next day I listened to my message from work, and I found out where the meeting was, and it was close by to where I live. And it was at St. Jude Hospital, and he was just at St. Jude Hospital, so what a coincidence. And so I went there, and I don't remember a whole heck of a lot how I got there. I remember looking at a lady, and she looked like she was going where I was going, so I followed her, and when she got out of her car, I asked her if she was going to the Al-Anon meeting, and she said yes, and she walked me into my meeting. And I see that lady occasionally. She doesn't remember me, but I remember her. And every time I see her, I remind her and I thank her for walking me into that meeting, because she helped me to get there. She didn't even know what she was doing. And I don't remember a whole heck of a lot about that first meeting. I know that there's ladies in my home group that told me that they remember me walking in and trying to talk to me, and I wouldn't talk to them. I don't remember them. The only person I remember is the lady that 12-stepped me to my home group, and I'm grateful for her. You know, she's not in our group anymore, but I know that God uses people to help other people. And I know I'm grateful that she was there that night, and that when she shared with me, I identified. You know, I had a few days before beat him up, and I walked in the house, and I knew there was a car in the driveway, and I knew that something was going on there. I knew it wasn't right, but I wasn't going to leave. I was going to go in there, and I was going to find out. And when I walked in the house, there was a woman sitting in the on the bed, and he was laying in bed. And she was like, she looked like she was like 70 years old. She was all wrinkled up and gray. And I thought, it's just her over me. And I went after her, and I hit her. And she ran out of the house like that. And I wasn't satisfied with that. Somebody was going to pay. And so I started beating up on him, and it pissed me off that he wouldn't fight back. You know, he wouldn't fight back with me. He just lay there, let me hit him. And I pulled the blankets off the bed, and I thought, I'll be damned if somebody's going to sleep on the blankets that I paid for. And I threw him in the fireplace, and I lit him on fire. And that's my insanity. Like, that was going to make me feel better. And, you know, it's like all of a sudden I realized, what the hell am I doing? You know, and I turned that fire off, and I said to myself, well, nobody knows what happens. I know, God knows, I'm not saying anything about this. And the next day, I didn't say anything about it. He didn't say anything about it. So it was okay, but inside I was dying. And that night that I went to my first meeting, she shared something with me that made it safe for me to share that with her. And it gave me some relief that somebody knew what it was like. Somebody knew what it felt like to have that anger inside of you. And she asked me for my phone number, and I don't know why she gave it to me, because I was really kind of iffy with white people. You know, I didn't trust them because I thought you were better than me, because that's the mentality that I grew up with. I grew up in a neighborhood with Mexicans and blacks, and we were the poor people, and the white people were the rich people, and they were the ones that had the good life. And but I trusted her. There was just something that I trusted her. And the next day she called me, and she would talk to me in a way that I thought, it's like, this is kind of manipulative, because she asked me things and I don't really get a chance to say no, and I end up doing things that I really didn't want to do. And I'm grateful for that, because if it weren't for that, I wouldn't have made it to that second meeting. And that second meeting is where I call my home group now. And that's where I saw the attraction. That's where I saw what I wanted. And I kept going back, and eventually I didn't want to go back to that Monday night meeting anymore, because I thought, do I have to go there? Because I thought, one thing that I grew up with was with loyalty. And I thought that I had to go back to that meeting, because that's the first place that I went to, and that's where I found the hope. And I kept coming back, and he got sober for a while. And one of the things that I heard when I first got here was that a newly sober alcoholic can't live with an old idea. Either he's going to leave you, or he's going to get drunk. And that was something that I never heard before. You know, I knew how not to support sobriety. I learned that very well on my own, and I didn't need anybody's help. I didn't know how to support sobriety. And I heard, keep coming back. And I was really desperate. And there's a lot of little phrases that I heard. Believe that I believe that your life is going to get better. I cried like, I don't know how many meetings. I just cried every meeting that I came to. But every time I left, I felt better. And I'm grateful that we were really busy that first year that I got here. It's like we were always going all over the place, and I didn't know how to say no, so I was going all over the place with everybody, and I didn't even know where the hell I was going. I was just going. And I'm grateful for that, because I remember one of the first things that I got to do is I got to go listen to Arbutus share, and I heard a lot of hope there, and I heard a lot of strength there. And I came home so excited, and when I talked to him, he was just like, whatever. And when I told him I was working the steps, he said, oh, you're trying to be like, you're an AA. And but I didn't care. You know, I didn't care, and I started to get stronger. And, you know, I always had that anxiety about me that he's going to get drunk again. And he told me that if I kept coming back, that irregardless of whether he stayed drunk or sober, that I was going to be okay. And I believed. I believed that. And, you know, that pain that I had inside of me started to ease. And it's been a process. You know, I heard that recovery is not a destination, it's a journey. And it has been a journey. And things got better, and, you know, eventually he did drink again. And when I got here to the program, I had this pain inside of me that I thought that I can't live without him. That if anything were to happen to him, or if he were to leave me, that I would die. And, you know, that feeling went away. And I didn't know. I was asked whether I wanted to stay or go, and I didn't know. I just knew that I didn't want to feel the pain anymore, and I was told that you'll know when you know. I didn't know what the hell that meant, but I believed. Whatever you were saying, I believed. I had nothing else anymore left. And, you know, the day that he drank, I knew he was drunk. I came home after a meeting. The windows were open. There was newspaper all over the place. The TV was on, all the doors were open, and nobody's home. And I knew. You know, so I didn't have to see him drunk to know, because I knew what it was like to live that way. And I'd experienced that before. And I didn't call my sponsor like I should have. I went out and looked for him, and I knew that there was a guy that he had just gotten sober with, so I called him. So we both, on our own, decided to look for him, and we would check with each other when we found him. And, you know, by the second day, I couldn't handle it anymore, and I did place that call to my sponsor. And I told her, I can't do this anymore. And she said, you have choices. And I said, well, how am I going to do this? You know, every time I say I'm leaving, I come back. And she told me exactly what to say. You know, and she told me how to say it. Because, see, every time I said I'm leaving and I left, I always left that little door open. I'm leaving because you're drinking. You know, it's like I always left it open for him to say, well, I'll do this now and then I'll go back. I never said I'm leaving. Don't call me anymore. And she told me, you know, when he calls, just say, I'm leaving. Don't call me anymore. That's all you got to say. And, you know, when I got that call, I said that. And, you know, that he didn't call me back. It's been 6 years later and he still hasn't called me. And I lived alone the first year and a half of the program. I lived by myself. And, you know, it's like the group was the attraction, but I just didn't know how to get in the middle. With the help of a sponsor and the ladies in my home group, I started to learn. And I got the opportunity to move in a house with some ladies in the program. I didn't want to because I thought, this is a step backwards. I'm becoming dependent on somebody when I'm independent. And this just doesn't seem right. And my sponsor at the time told me, who are you going to work a program with at home? The four walls? How are you ever going to learn how to work a program with somebody? And I want it more, so I had the willingness to do it. And no matter what I've been through in this program, I've always wanted more, and I've always had hope. And nothing that I've ever walked through in this program has been as bad as it was before I got here. So I've always had that willingness to keep going forward. And I got the opportunity to move into the houses with some of the ladies, and I'm grateful for that opportunity. I still get to live with some of the ladies, and I've gotten to live with a bunch of different ladies. They've gotten married and moved on, and it's been a growing situation. And I know that those ladies have saved my butt. You know, when I've gone through surrenders in this program, and getting to come home and have them there has saved me. I remember I was like 2 years in the program, and I got talked to very strongly. And I thought, F this. I don't need this. You know, this hurts almost as much as that hurt out there. And how can this help me? And I had a plan in my head. I'll get home before they do. I had furniture. All my furniture was there. I'm like, I'll move out. Like, yeah, I'm going to move all the furniture and everything before they get home. And when I opened that door, there was a lady standing there. And she's like, what's up? And she saved me for that night. You know, and I'm grateful for her. And just little God shots like that have saved me. But, you know, I've always had the willingness to do the work and to go forward, because I have to keep reminding myself that nothing's as bad in here as it was out there. And in the big book, it talks about those who do not recover are those who cannot be rigorously honest. I didn't know how to be rigorously honest when I got here. You know, I surfaced everything. And I had a lot of enablers in my life, people that fixed things for me, people that gave me jobs. People that, they did everything for me. I never had to be responsible. I always had the right job, but it was never because I looked for it. It's because somebody got it for me. It's like I've always had those people that have padded it along the way for me. And I know that once I got here to the program, nobody was padding anything along the way for me. It's like I had to get honest. And, you know, after being here and not having a drunk to blame for everything, I got to really look at myself. And that was, for me, that was the hardest thing. You know, because I had a lot of self-hate, a lot of self-loathing. I didn't like myself, you know, and I'm grateful for that Monday night AA step study that the Al-Anons get to participate in, because that's where I got to get honest. That's where I really got to look at myself. That's where I really got to work the steps rigorously and look at myself and make the changes. And I'm grateful for the long-timers in our group that pretty much they set the pace in that meeting. You know, and for all the help that I've gotten through that meeting, I'm grateful for the alcoholics that go there, because there was a point where I didn't believe in myself and I hated myself. And I felt like all the ladies in my home group hated me, but you guys loved on me. And I'm grateful for you guys. And I remember my first sponsor telling me when I'd, you know, be all whiny about my brothers drinking and they're not here for me, and she'd say, what a shame that you're whining about those ones that are out there drunk when you got a room full of brothers that are sober. And at first I didn't get it, but today I know what she meant. You know, it's like Guillermo reminds me a lot of my brother. And so I get those little annoyances reminding her of him. But, you know, it's like, I love you. He helped to remind me why I keep coming back. Because you know what, though? The thing is that I'm a lot like him. I'm a lot like him. And sometimes I got to back out because I know where I go. You know, I can be sarcastic and I can be cutty. And I'll look for the weak one. You know, that's what I do. I look for the weak ones. And those are the ones that I pick on. And it's like I learned here that I don't have to have fun at somebody's expense. You know, and but I get to enjoy life too. And, you know, I've gotten to walk through surrenders in this program, and to get to where I'm at today, I've gotten to really look at me, you know, and to find out why am I here. You know, I'm not just here because that man got me here to the program. I'm here because I need to be here. And today, I know that I was thinking, you know, before when I got this commitment, like, what do I have to share that's spiritual? And then when I got here on Friday, I thought, you know, I'm going to hear my answer this weekend. And I have, you know, this whole weekend has been spiritual. You know, God has been here. You know, you guys have been my God with skin. And I got to walk through that surrender and really look at myself. And I got to take some action. You know, I was given direction to do things like write 5 good things that I liked about myself every day. And I got reminded to look in the mirror and say, I love you, Cindy, every morning. You know, I got to put some effort into my outside appearance because I had just totally, like, screw this, you know. It's like my outsides were matching my insides. And I got to, you know, I started to get commitments. And one of the commitments that I got was to, I had a lot of shame about my family. I didn't want to talk about them. But I had some loyalty, too, that, you know, don't talk bad about my family. It's my family. You know, so I'd code all that, and I got to, and I get to go to Spanish meetings and participate in that program. And this is the first time I share in English. I always have shared in Spanish, so it's pretty cool. And I've gotten to go there, and you know, really, it's like I've learned through them what it's like to give for fun and for free, and not to expect anything back, and but not to give up either. You know, because it's so easy to say, you know what, they don't want to do it. They don't want to work. They don't want to do anything. But, you know, there's little spurts of them that now that are coming out, you know, it's like they've hung out there in the program for years and they've just been content with what they have. You know, they've taken the crumbs instead of going for the whole cookie. And there's hope there, you know, and I know that that's helped me to be able to give without expecting anything in return, without getting any recognition. Because nobody knows what I'm doing. God knows what I'm doing, though. You know, and that's where I've gotten a lot from. It's like I got to step up the things that I was doing. But one thing that I get to learn is that I don't stop doing the things that have helped me to get better. I do more, you know, and I can't stop. And, you know, it's like I think about the things I do, and I do them because I have to do them. Not so much because I have to, because I need to, because I want this way of life. You know, if I let up, I know where I go. You know, and I don't want to go back to where I've been. You know, I've come a long way, and I'm not going back. I want what the long-timers want, having this program. That's the attraction to me. And if I want what they have, I need to do what they do. And there's no buts. You know, it's like I hear about, yeah, but. I'm like, no, there's no buts. It's like I believe any direction that I've been given from somebody with time, I don't question it. I believe it. You know, because I know that every time I follow that direction, my life has gotten better. It doesn't matter how uncomfortable it's been walking through it. It doesn't matter what do they think about me because you're telling me this. It doesn't matter. It's like, F the vote, what I heard. One of my friends told me when I was walking through the surrender, she kept telling me, F the vote. Who cares what anybody thinks about you? And, you know, I had to get to the point where really it's like, I don't care what anybody thinks about me. When I got to that first meeting, I didn't care what anybody thought. When I was out there yelling and screaming at the drunk and beating him up in public, I didn't care what anybody thought. You know, so why did all of a sudden I come here and I started caring about what everybody thought about me? You know, when I didn't come here for friends. I didn't. I came here to stop the pain. I didn't want to keep doing the things that I was doing that were causing me pain, that were hurting the people that I loved. And, you know, it's just, I've been listening to, it's like my friend Marcia was telling me, I sent this little email to her, and she said, you don't have to, she told me something about, are you sending me this because you're trying to get spiritual? I'm like, oh, you know me. I was like, I was like, God, help me this week so I don't have any piss off, so I don't do anything negative, so that when I get here, I'm okay. And I come home on Friday night to a drunk with a beer can and a kitchen torn up. Our landlord's a drunk. And he didn't expect me to be there. He knew that the girls had left earlier to come down here, and he didn't expect me to come home. So when I walked into the house, there were drawers all over the floor from the kitchen. The refrigerator was on the other side. And there was stuff all over the place, and there was a beer can there. And the radio was on, blaring, and he was there. And he looked at me like, what are you doing here? And, you know, he tries to hide his drinking from us. And, like, we don't know. He knows, you know, there's big books all over the house. There's Al-Anon literature all over the house. And every time somebody moves down out of one of his houses, he says, do any of your people need a place to live? Because he knows, you know, we've been consistent with our rent. We've been respectful of that home. And he knows, you know, he knows that there's something there. And, you know, I walked out of the house, and when I came back, there was a bag over the beer can. And I said, don't you know I'm an Al-Anon? I could smell it. And you know, I got to ask him. I said, you know, I need some time to get ready. Do you think you can leave? And he said, are you asking me to leave? And I said, yes. And he said, well, can I have a half hour? And I was like, okay. And, you know, it's like, you know, I just got a reminder of why I keep coming back. It's like we get to work a program, even with our landlord. And, you know, there's one loving thing, though, that it's like I know that drunks, whether you're alcoholic and you're sober, or whether you're a drunk, they're loving. You know, I have this neat story about him. And I wanted to plant flowers in front of the house. And our house is like green, no flowers, nothing. And I asked him one day if it was okay if I pulled out some of the stuff that was on the side and I put some flowers there. And I said, you don't have to worry about it. I'll do the work and I'll pay for it. And he's like, well, okay. I can have somebody do it for you. He said, no, it's okay. I'll do it. He said, well, what kind of flowers are you going to put there? And I said, I want calla lilies. I said, I'll buy them. You don't have to worry about it. And that was in the morning. And when I came home at night from my meeting, there were calla lilies planted there. And they were in bloom. And I was like, I love Mike. I love alcoholics. And that's why I keep coming back. And, you know, I'm grateful for AA, for the program that it's given me. I'm grateful for my life. You know, it's like I've heard long time to share, this is a design for living. It's like I was given the steps and the traditions. I was given the fellowship. I was given long-timers with their experience, strength, and hope. And I've been taught how to live life. And, you know, that's really that's what this program has given me. It's taught me how to live life, because what I did out there was not living life. I took actions, and I was crazy. I was crazy. And I've gotten how to be respectful, how to feel good about myself, how to feel good about the actions that I take. I used to hear a lot as people go up to share on their birthday, is I get to be a lady today. And I thought, it's like, I'm a lady, and I know the difference today, what it's like. You know, I have this job that it's a God job, because my boss, I told him when I was new, because he was my boss at a different place before, that because I was excited that I had come to Al-Anon and I was feeling better, and I tried to tell him all about it, and I don't know that he remembers, but I know that I get to work with him now in a different aspect. He owns a company, and he called me over to work for him. And, you know, what's really cool about it is that because of this program, I know how to show up to work on time. I know how to be responsible. I know how to, it's like he doesn't have to worry that, you know, he's entrusted his business to me, that I'm gonna run it, and I'm not going to screw him over, and that I'm going to be there. And he trusts me. And the first 6 weeks of that job, when he asked me to come work for him, he wasn't ready for me, but he paid me for 6 weeks to stay home. You know, and that's because I've gotten to change in this program, because you've taught me, you know, how that, because I used to argue with him a lot because I thought I knew better than him. And today I just keep my mouth shut. You know, and anytime I have a program function, it's like it can be a last minute thing. I don't have to tell him where I'm going. I just ask him, can I be off this day? And he's okay. And then he asked me one time about how many people, he heard me talking to somebody, well, there's probably going to be 100 of us. And he said, "You have a lot of friends." He said, "Is it like a club?" And I said, "Yeah, sort of." And he knows that I have a lot of friends because, you know, some of you have gotten to come to my work and meet him. And he's a neat man. You know, it's like not everybody has to have a program to be to have principles. And that's one thing I got to learn. I need a program to have principles. And today I get to do it different, too, in the dating area. You know, I get to be in a relationship today, and I get to be faithful. And, you know, my eye doesn't wander looking for something else because I have found what I needed inside of me. You know, it's not a man that's going to fix me. You know, the man I get to date, he's a plus in my life, and I'm grateful for his program. I'm grateful that he wants to be sober, you know, that I don't have to try to get him to work the steps. I'm going to have to read the steps with him and teach him how to work the steps, because that's what I did before I got here. You know, and I'm grateful for the tool of sponsorship, because I know that my sponsor is teaching me how to be in a relationship, you know, how to communicate, you know, that, you know, it's not the mind reading game. And I'm grateful that he supports my program. And you know, he, like I said, he adds to my life. You know, and it's like, you know, I'm not that clingy, needy person that I used to be. It's like, you know, I know wherever he's at, he's safe and he's doing what he needs to do. You know, and I trust. And a lot of what I've got is I trust in sponsorship. I trust in the strength of our group. And, you know, if anything, that's the basis of everything. In our group, the strength is sponsorship and the long-timers. You know, and they set the pace. And, you know, if you want what they've got, you got to do what they're doing. If not, you'll be gone. You know, and this is not, and my grandson just says, "This is not the PTA." And I remember her telling me that before. I'm like, huh? That was like a lot of the stuff. It'd be like, huh? Today I get it. Today I know what she means. You know, I've gotten to work with people that don't want to be here. They just want to hang out. They want to do the social thing. This is not a social club. You know, and I get to tell them all the things that I got to hear, you know, and I've gotten to find a belief for myself, a purpose for myself, and this is my belief. I know I need to be here. I want to be here. You know, I want to live this way of life. You don't have to sell it to me. You know, it's like you don't, there's no, it's like I want this for myself, and I know it works, but you got to do the work. You know, you can't just hang out. You got to take the risk. You got to raise your hand. You got to do that commitment that scares the hell out of you and not worry about what anybody thinks about you, because you're going to learn. You're going to learn through doing it. And I'm just really grateful for everyone being here, for my home group. It's like I was telling Chris that I don't just consider the girls my home group. It's like the guys are my home group too, because I've needed everybody. And it's like I didn't just need a sponsor. Is not the only thing that's going to do it for me. I need everybody, you know. And I'm grateful for the newcomers. You know, I got to stay back on Friday night and fulfill a commitment that I have at a Friday night meeting as a secretary. And, you know, I thought, nobody's going to show up. They raise their hand, because I started getting calls during the day. I want to make amends. I raise my hand, and I'm not going tonight. I'm like, okay. And, you know, it's like I started getting those calls during the day at work. And then we set up the table thinking, well, if at all, maybe 10 people will show up. And there were 24 newcomers at that meeting. You know, it's like I know I have a purpose. You know, it's like I've got to follow that gut feeling, what God tells me, and you know, not go with the popularity vote. Like, okay, it's popular to be with everybody. I've got to do God's work, you know. And that just pumped me up for the whole weekend. And I was just like hyper the whole weekend. And today it's like I got to get all that energy out to be in the right place, you know, for this morning. And I'm grateful for that. I was really emotional this morning. Every time somebody would say something to me, I would cry. And I'm like, I don't want to get up there and blubber. And then, but there was a part of me that knew, it's like, you know what? God's going to kick in. God's going to help me through this. And you know, it's like, it all goes back to, I believe because you believe. I believe because you believed in me. And I'm grateful for that. And I'm grateful for you too back there, Keith. Because I know that for a long time, he was my cheerleader. You know, and I hear it from the alcoholic always first. You know, and that's just the way it is for me. It's like I heard it from Keith. Keith was my co-sponsor for a while. And you know what? He was giving me the same direction that my sponsor was giving me, but I was hearing it from him. You know, and I just love all of you guys, and I'm glad that I get to be here today. Thanks.